All right, we're going to fade that down because Terrascope is here. And we have two slightly intimidated looking, but we'll warm them up, friendly freshmen from MIT who are part of the Terrascope project. And I would like you to introduce yourselves first, your name, where you're from, and if you've decided on a major yet, because I know freshmen don't have to decide to the end of the year, but you can say that. So let's start with...
Okay. Hi, I'm Sherry Zoe. I'm a freshman, obviously, and I've declared biology and chemistry. It's a new major that's here at MIT.
Ah, and where are you from, Sherry?
I'm from Palo Alto, California.
Ah, okay. And Joey?
And I am Joey Nosik. I'm from Wilmington, Delaware, and I'm majoring in civil and environmental engineering.
Joey, I want to congratulate you. I've never met anyone from Delaware. Yes. I was convinced it didn't exist. And in my million years on this planet, you are the first person I've ever met who's actually from Delaware.
That's why I came to MIT, just to prove Delaware exists.
To prove that Delaware exists. Okay. Why don't either one of you or both of you tell me what Terrascope is and what the project is you were working on this year?
Right. So Terrascope is a program at MIT. It's one of the freshman learning communities. And there are three classes set aside for Terrascope. The mission statement over the whole year was, or more for the first class specifically, not so much for radio, but we still are staying relevant, is to develop a set of solutions for current cities that presents sustainable and equitable solutions to urban consumption by 2050. And so over the fall class, we had 12000, which unfortunately I forgot the word name of that class. And that was focused on making a website and a presentation to show like our ideas to solve pretty much all the problems of cities.
Now, who picked the topic?
The topic was chosen by the people running Terrascope.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
That was, I think that's actually largely the reason I joined over the summer. I got the postcard and I thought, what? You're studying cities? I want to do that.
So that was my next question. You knew going in this is what it was going to be. So Sherry, what you got there and they said, okay, study some cities, right? What happened?
So basically they threw us this huge idea of like, oh, the future of cities, what are we going to do? There's so many problems. And so we started out looking at different sections of cities and what the problems were, such as water, air, food, energy, and I can't remember the last one. Do you remember?
There was housing.
Housing, yeah. Right, yeah. And so basically we split up into groups at some point, and each group did some research on each of these categories, and then we all came together as a huge class of like 40 students, and we worked together to make a final project. So it was pretty crazy, but it was super fun and intense at the same time.
And I understand you did one specific city, or at least you visited a city during this year.
Yes. So during spring break, we went to Mexico City, and we spent a week there looking at all sorts of historical monuments, as well as wastewater treatment plants and stuff like that.
Yes. And we also went there with recording devices, and you'll get to hear many assorted sounds we collected there today.
And so I understand the title of this is... Oh, come on. Why isn't the computer coming on? I hate when this happens. It just went off on me. Huh.
Okay. Well, the title is The Snake on the Lake Was Not a Mistake, The Rise of Modern Mexico City.
And we are going to hear that. I had it all called up on the computer, and now the computer is off for some reason. This is MIT for you folks, yeah. The wonders of modern science. So let me play it on the CD. I thought it would be better on the computer, but we will do so. All right, and afterwards we'll come back and we'll talk some about putting this together and the process of that, and what you learned, and why you will never do it again. And all right.
You seem to be hundreds of years in the past, standing upon a lake. The fresh water sparkles and ripples gently under the bright midday sun. You look around and see beautiful mountain ridges, their gray-brown slopes capped with white snow. Some people approach. They gaze at you. No, through you, and point. Suddenly, they drop some rocks where they were pointing and build a city. Then, the stone structures around you quickly fade into clusters of modern buildings. Now, you, with 20 million of your closest friends, live in a massive metropolis placed neatly upon the lake. Except the lake doesn't exactly exist anymore. So you're now in a desert where water coming out of a faucet feels like coins coming out of a slot machine. And the mountains that surround you, they happen to be active volcanoes. Also, earthquakes like to drop by every once in a while, just to shake things up a little. So it turns out that you're trapped in this part of the city, and you need to get to the other side of it. What do? Walk? No, it's way too far. Drive? Nah, traffic is at a standstill. Bike? It's too dangerous. Subway? It could be worth a shot. You get on the subway. It's packed like a sardine can. The doors close, slicing the people who are just a bit too slow. Then, the train rushes to your destination, jerking hard enough to form a few human-shaped dents in the wall at each stop. You get off the subway and somehow your phone is no longer in your pocket. In fact, you don't have a pocket anymore. Somebody stole your pocket. That's it. You've had enough of the city. The daily temperature fluctuations, the ongoing water crisis, the danger of death by volcano, the slow transportation, the wall of mountains, the lurking risk of the chaotic martial rain people.
Ugh. You feel a bit shaky. It's been 5 weeks since you moved to Mexico City, and you're still having those nightmares. Your initial fears of what the city would be persist. All right, rise and shine. It's time for work. You roll out of bed and stifle a groan. Your long hair is a frizzy mess, an absolute monster to comb, and your skin is soaked in sweat. You hastily get dressed for work, as your casual clothes lie temptingly atop your dresser. Your breakfast is only a speedy cup of coffee, before you sprint off to the street where you try to catch a minibus. After a long ride, you arrive at the subway, where you join the throngs of people surging towards the doors. 50 minutes pass on the train, standing practically in a stranger's arms, until at last your transfer comes. 2 left turns and a flight of stairs later, you're back on another train. Navigating through the intersections of blue and green and pink and red lines used to baffle you, but after following the flow of thousands of people in the station for the past few weeks, you're starting to get the hang of it too. Your stop comes, and soon you emerge into the free air. You only have a few minutes more before you'll be trapped in an office again. You savor them. Your shift is long. Afterwards, you grab drinks with your coworkers, as you often do, but tonight you decide to duck out early. All you want is your bed, but you have to make your way back through the city again before getting there. You take one subway, transfer onto another, and eventually end your journey back on a minibus, headed towards the edge of the city. The summer rains begin to fall. They've come late today. Your favorite scent, that peculiar way that concrete smells when it's wet, floats in through the window. You smile. Finally, you're back. It feels strange, how this place and the city are starting to feel more and more like home. Mexico City can hardly be called perfect, but something about it's beginning to capture your love. It has a beauty in its haphazard ways and in its people. A shower helps get the tension out of your shoulders, and the rain falling on your roof helps lull you to sleep.
Vibrant.
Surprising.
Diverse. Mexico City is thriving with chaos and confusion. I'm Jacob Miski.
And I'm Jennifer Liu. We visited Mexico City as part of a group of students studying urban resilience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we had done some research on the city beforehand.
We learned about some of its problems, the water crisis, the sprawl, and the transit system. But we were amazed that it functioned pretty smoothly, and we were taken aback by the beauty of the city.
We talked to a lot of people and asked them why this city manages to work. Professor Roberto Rodriguez teaches architecture at Tecnológico de Monterrey. He said that the answers are rooted in Mexico City's history, and he told us a legend about the city's beginnings. It was a divine message that guided the Mexica tribe to their new home.
The gods tell to one of the leaders, when you find an eagle eating a snake in a small island, you make the foundation of the city there.
This just so happened to be on a tiny island in the middle of a giant lake. So that's where the leaders of the Mexica tribe decided to settle. Surrounded by water and snow-capped volcanoes, their civilization grew into the Aztec Empire, and their city into Tenochtitlan, their royal capital.
Usually, cities use the surrounding land for agriculture to support their population. But Tenochtitlan was in the middle of a lake. How does one go about building a farm on water?
For the Aztecs, willow trees, bundles of reeds, some mud, and a lot of ingenuity. They combined mud with branches over the shallow lake bed, forming floating islands rooted by trees and posts.
But then the conquistadors arrived. They overturned Aztec society, their language, and their culture. The two groups of people blended, and from there, modern Mexico City was born. Walking through the Zocalo, the historic center of town, you can see a live timeline of the transformation. There are modern stores next to colonial-style government buildings, next to a huge Gothic-inspired cathedral.
But what about the Aztecs? Their city lies underneath the plaza. The excavation of the Templo Mayor, one of the main temples, is right outside the square.
The Spaniards completely changed the city, building over the pyramids and draining the lakes. In fact, most of the canals are now paved streets. But some of the Aztecs' original canals and floating islands remain, although the atmosphere of the waterways is a bit different now. Colorful, gondola-like boats called trajineras, with names like Laura and Gabriela, crowded the water with partiers and locals. Mariachi played along the banks, hoping it picked up.
Vendors in their own little boats definitely capitalized on this odd mix of partiers and families, all taking a trip down the waterways. They had soft drinks, beer, corn on the cob, mini stoves with fresh tacos, and they appeared out of nowhere.
But it was our eighth day there, so we weren't super surprised. People managed to find creative places to sell their goods, from vendors on boats to ones on subway trains selling pens, to men walking through the highways selling pistachios. There's always some form of a market, and it's been that way since the Aztecs.
In the National Museum of Anthropology, Professor Ruben Gutierrez, who teaches architecture at Tec de Monterrey, showed us a diorama of an Aztec market.
You can witness that the street life and selling things in the outdoors was a historical factor that continues through our days.
Informal stands of magazines and candy, large outdoor markets under tents, filled with loud music and noisy chatter. Markets were everywhere.
Commercial chain supermarkets have come to Mexico City, but the culture of outdoor markets persists, despite competition from these larger, big brand options.
We made a special trip to the Mercado de San Juan, a well-established indoor public market. It's located in a warehouse-like building that lets air circulate and where light casts a natural glow onto the towers of fresh produce.
There, we met Olavita, a small woman with large glasses who says that she's the oldest vendor in the market. Like many of the vendors, she let us taste some of her food, including her homemade mole, a savory Mexican salsa made with chili powder and chocolate.
The amazing thing is, she's been there since she was 9, following in the footsteps of the last 6 generations of her family. She's grown up with the market and seen all its changes.
She told us that the vendors used to display their goods on the ground. But since then, the stands in the market have expanded upward. And the city, it's grown outward.
The capital of Mexico was smaller. There were fewer of us.
Today, houses blanket the surrounding hills like a bright patchwork quilt. It's expensive to live near the city center.
A lot of people are forced to live on the outskirts. As a result, Mexico City's area is 5 times bigger than it was in 1950. It's now almost twice the size of New York City.
A good city should be one that allows you the opportunity to have a roof, to have a home, to have a shelter. And it's a city that gives you access. Access to opportunity, access to cultural experience, access to jobs. In Mexico, we've been able to deliver both, but never bundled.
Onesimo Flores, CEO of Conecta Cuatro, an urban planning and transit consultancy, explained the government's efforts to keep the city moving.
So you want access to opportunity, you live close to the central areas of Mexico City. You want access to a roof, and I mean, you know, for the vast majority of the people that have a lower income, you have to move 20, 30, 40 kilometers away. And part of the challenge is how do we rethink that equation and try to put them together.
That tug of war between job opportunities and affordable housing really comes out in the complex structure of the transit system.
Mexico City's transit system is a chaotic masterpiece. In the beginning, the city had a government-owned subway system and a privately-owned bus system.
However, an informal bus system rose, and it was winning.
So in the very late 70s, the government decided to take over all of the buses in the city and to create a government-owned bus company. And it was planning nirvana.
They envisioned wider roads, an expanded subway, and a bus system to complement it. It was supposed to revolutionize transit.
And it was a time where planners and government officials were really ambitious. They thought they could completely reshape the city. So what happened? What happened was complexity. Administering a bus company with over 2,000 buses at that time proved a very complex challenge. The buses didn't get fixed. The schedules weren't met. So eventually, this bus company started to die.
But a replacement quickly swooped in. An informal system began, where taxi drivers would pick up multiple riders and take them where they needed to go.
Eventually, these taxis were replaced with minibuses, and routes became more formalized.
At the beginning, there were government raids to stop these big, bad, informal operators from cannibalizing transit demand from the bus company. But eventually, the government realized that, in essence, these informal operators were the guys that were enabling the city to keep moving.
It is a highly disorganized way of getting people to their destinations, but somehow it works.
But what's really interesting is how the structures come about. What works doesn't necessarily come from piles of blueprints or complicated planning by large organizations. It comes from the people who love the city. Here's Veronica Najera. She's a chef, and she's lived here all her life.
I love Mexico. I love the people. They care about each other. That's what I love most.
Get up, brush your teeth, go on your way. It's a nice day, and you like to see the sunshine. You get on the minibus to work. There's traffic again. No surprise. You watch as the hills crawl past, mosaics of houses painted more colors than you have names for. Sprawling communities, interweaving transport systems, vendors lining the streets. 21 million people. In a living, evolving city full of culture, full of history, full of life. A place of chaotic harmony. You lean your head against the window and admire the view.
This piece was produced by Terrascope Radio, a class at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, developed in collaboration with MIT's program in Comparative Media Studies. Terrascope is a freshman learning community focused on solving complex environmental issues and is a part of the Office of Experiential Learning. We would like to thank all the people we spoke with during our time in Mexico City. We also give thanks to Professor David McGee for leading the Terrascope program and fall class, to Emily Martin for planning many of the logistics of our trip, to Laura Bergman, our undergraduate teaching fellow, for keeping us in line, to Libby Shu and Dr. Louisa Pinto, who skillfully helped us translate throughout the trip, and to Ari Epstein, the instructor of Terrascope Radio, for guiding us through the making of our piece. I'm Joey Nusik.
I'm Anthony Cheng.
I'm Aro Ricardo Perez Lopez.
I'm Janice Shu.
I'm Sarah Wu.
I'm Eden Van Said.
I'm Sherry Zhou.
I'm Asia Chapman.
I'm Raina Higuchi.
I am Mei Wu.
I'm Jacob Miski.
I'm Jennifer Liu.
And we are Terrascope Radio 2017.
Well, that was excellent, I have to say. And I do not myself do any public affairs programming here at the station, but I know people who do, and that's a lot of work. You know, somebody like me, I just come and throw the records on that I've been listening to all the time anyway. But stuff like that. Talk a little about the process of putting that all together.
First of all, thank you, Fred, and thank you, WMBR, for letting us play our thing. The process, we had a whole semester-long class for this. At first, you know, some of us had listened to a lot of, you know, talk radio before. Some of us, like me, had really not, but I was definitely still very interested in the concept. So we basically had to learn making a program like this from the bottom up. So we listened to a lot of radio pieces, mostly shorter ones, about 5 minutes, but some of them were longer, and from all different genres too. Some documentaries like this, there are some comedy in there, some really weird stuff, and got the feel for, you know, what radio sounds like, what we like to hear, because what we like to hear is hopefully what other people are going to like to hear.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on this thing. We pulled an all-nighter at some point, but...
Just one?
Also known as 2 days ago.
Very true.
I have to say, Ari sent me a email, I think it was... was it yesterday at 4 or something? Something like that. And said, oh, they're all done. And I was like, they're all done. It was like, I thought I would get this at like 3 in the morning, the day of the show. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, thankfully that did not happen. But we all spent a lot of time beforehand dividing up the work and making sure all the parts were in order and going through them over and over and over again, doing edits and more edits and more edits and critiquing and giving feedback and doing changes. don't know, how many times do you think we did that?
Okay, well, it was like at least 10 over this weekend, and then we had about like 2 or 3 every week for like the 2 or 3 weeks before that. So, yes, yeah, somewhere between 14 and 20. I've heard this a lot.
Now, was there only one version of this? Because when I did this 2 years ago, they said at the end they actually had 3 different versions of it and had to decide. I think I remember that correctly. Maybe. So, was this the final one that you all, you know, decided on, or were there other versions that came up?
Basically, yes, this was our final version. Mm-hmm. We actually managed to come to a consensus, quite surprisingly, I think, because we were all so conflicted on many different parts of the piece. But at some point, we were like, okay, yes, this is the way it is. We're keeping it as it is. We're not going to tweak it anymore. We're done.
I think I forgot exactly how long ago it was. The time is confusing with... somebody actually put up on our chat that, you know, this was a week old, and like this recording we have is a week old, and it's like, a week ago we didn't have a script, so there's no way we could have recorded that a week ago. But anyways, a few weeks back in the process, we decided that we split into 4 groups, and each group made something. Well, one group really made a full-on script. My group did a very, very minimal script, but basically each script had a different concept to it, just to see what we liked. And the direction we ended up going with after that was sort of a like Frankensteinian combination of those 4 concepts.
Well, it worked out, right?
Yes.
I completely forgot about that part. It was so long ago. I can't believe it.
But I imagine there were times when somebody was like, no, this has to go in. And other people say, no, we've got to have something else. Or am
I think
exaggerating?
I think the majority rules for most part. If most people think this should belong or shouldn't belong, we just followed the majority.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best and, I guess, fairest way of doing it.
Now, who decided on Mexico City? Was it the instructors?
Yes. There's actually a funny coincidence there. So in the fall class, we made our presentation, and we decided that we were going to have an example city at the end to say, you know, how should all these ideas we have be applied to one actual city? And for some reason, because we had no idea we were going to Mexico City yet, but for some reason after deliberation, we decided on Mexico City. And then just like a week or two later, I think it was the last Terrascope class of the fall, we were told what the city would be, and it was Mexico City.
Yeah, we found that very funny. Such a coincidence, too. Like, we picked Mexico City, and they're like, no, we didn't pick Mexico City because you guys picked Mexico City. But we're like, well, it's still Mexico City, so... Yeah, it was cool to get to see, like, how... Like, we looked at it and then be there and see how it actually was, because mm-hmm. it was so different. And I think that was the most, that was the biggest thing that stood out to us.
What was different? What was the most different, or some of the different things?
So, for most of us, a lot of us were, like, ingrained in, like, thinking that, oh, Mexico City is, like, filled with problems. Like, problems are everywhere. Like, there's problems here, there's problems, there's, like, lists and lists of problems you could go through. But, like, being there, like... You could see everyone was, like, happy with their life, and, like, yes, there were problems, but they weren't as, like, everywhere and omnipotent as we thought they were. So, like, the water, they're, like, for example, the water crisis, like, they don't have enough water in the city, and they have to either drain their aquifers, which is creating problems, and, like, or just bring it from, like, miles and miles away. But to be honest, like, people there, like, even though the water for us wasn't safe to drink because we never lived there for a long period of time, for them it was just their daily life and their daily routines, mm-hmm. and didn't affect the way they did things.
What do you think is the overriding problem in Mexico City? If you had to pick one, what do you think is, or a couple?
So I think, and I don't think anything from this was mentioned in the program, but there was one day I went to UNAM, which is like the Autonomous University of Mexico City, I think is the translation of that acronym. And we sat down in this hall, and there were a bunch of people there to hear this presentation about like the resilience of Mexico City going forward and what needs to be done about that. And I thought it was very interesting because in the discussion that was brought up by like the other viewers of this presentation, because there's a whole question and answer section after that, which went on for quite a while and had a lot of interesting points brought up, was that it seemed that at least what the people there thought were the two biggest problems were, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is inequality and lack of trust in the government. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was incredibly interesting because, you know, those are essentially, you know, our big problems in America too, and they manifest themselves in quite different ways, but the fact that it all just comes down to that was quite mind-blowing.
Now, Jerry and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on your name.
Joey,
that's it. I should remember that. That's my son-in-law's brother. What was the biggest thing you learned from the whole experience? Not just necessarily this particular topic, but the whole Terrascope experience. What do you think is the most important thing you learned?
I think probably just the power of looking for the answers yourself. I think, you know, most classes tend to be a sort of, you know, the professor comes forward and just tells you stuff, then you get an exam, which has various levels of relation to what the professor told you, depending on the class, and you basically just, spit back what the professor told you, which is definitely effective for various things, like definitely, you know, when you're first learning about some subject, it's very important. But I think that, you know, in Terrascope, I felt that, you know, there isn't a lot of teaching in Terrascope, but there is a very humongous amount of learning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just from, you know, and, you know, so the instructors of Terrascope are more of like facilitators to allow you to, you know, do your research and get the projects together, but really it's you deciding, hey, you know, there's this big picture, but this is what I want to focus on, this picture. Let's just find out all about it and figure out what we should do about it.
Yeah, I agree with Joey. Like, there's so many group projects that got, like, there was teams of one, teams of five, teams of 10, teams of the whole class. I feel like group work was definitely an essential part of Terrascope in both the fall and spring classes because it required a lot of effort and, I guess, communication between everyone to get all things straightened out and ready and stuff like that. But also, I feel like one thing that was very important in Terrascope is the ability to reflect and look back on what you've done, no matter where you are in the process, because sometimes you just need to take a step back and look at what you've done and be like, yeah, so that's actually not too bad. It's not as bad as I thought it was, or something like that. So, yeah, especially with this piece, it just, the feeling of being done and being able to appreciate it the way it is very nice. Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd like to send a message if any future MIT students are listening, whether already admitted coming in this coming term or a few years out, like, you know, I obviously recommend to do Terrascope. It's great, and a warning, it is a lot of work, and it's there are definitely some nights it's painful and you're wondering why you're doing it, but it's all more than worth it. It's, you know, it, at the end, you've done something amazing, and it doesn't matter, like, how much you didn't want to do it on some nights beforehand. I didn't know I could do this, but I did. And, like, in fact, there's the other Spring Terrascope class, 1016 Design for Complex Environmental Issues, and we had our presentations last week for that, known as the Bazaar of Ideas, where we had our designs built and people went around and looked at it. And, you know, our instructor, Ari Epstein, told us afterwards, yeah, sitting right here.
So you better say something next.
Yes. He told us afterwards that apparently, you know, a lot of the people there, even though that they happened to be MIT people and knew what MIT was, they could not believe that we were only freshmen. And
well, one final question. It's actually two questions. One, you got any more finals left, or are you?
Oh yeah.
All right. Well, I should probably let you go so you can go, you know, obsess about those, right? And do you have plans for the summer?
So I'm planning on staying actually around here at MIT. I'm going to be doing some research in the lab that I'm currently working in, and I'm super excited because I'll get to hang around here in Cambridge and in Boston and get to know this place much better.
Ah. And Joey?
I'm going home, not entirely sure what I'm doing yet, if anything. But I'll probably find something to do.
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, and thank you, Ari, for bringing you over. And as I said, that was a very good presentation. If you guys want to do more radio, we're always looking for students. And you don't have to work that hard. You can actually just play some music on a show. just do what all the students do now. I bring CDs, and sometimes people have records, and kids today, they just plug in their laptops and play their stuff. But thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.